from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Lillian Rubin is 88, and her health is declining. After watching her husband slip into Alzheimer's, she says she wants to choose when and how she dies. Should we make that final choice for ourselves, or should we prolong life no matter what the cost? We'll examine these questions and how social policies shape our views on aging. Our guests will include Lillian Rubin, who is a sociologist and psychologist and author of the recent Salon article, Let's Talk About Dying, and author of 60 on Up, The Truth About Aging in America, and Ken Dykewalt, president and CEO at AgeWave, an organization that focuses on studying populations of aging. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. San Francisco resident and sociologist and author Lillian Rubin recently published an article in Salon.com about the quality of life as we age and the question of our own autonomy and deciding whether or not to make our final exit voluntarily. The article brings us to the serious and often terribly vexing questions about when life should end and the obvious effect on family, loved ones, and the healthcare system. We brought Lillian Rubin together this hour with Bay Area gerontologist, psychologist, and author Ken Dykewalt, who's president and CEO of AgeWave, who has for many years been one of the nation's leading experts on aging populations. And let me welcome Ken Dykewalt. Good morning.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Great to have you here. And Lillian Rubin, good morning.
Good morning. Always a pleasure, Michael.
Always a pleasure to have you. And this is a tough topic. We're talking about, even before we went on the air, how it's something that people don't like to talk about, don't want to talk about. But I think particularly in terms of the healthcare system and public policy and even your own lives need to talk about. Let's start off by getting some of your story, Lillian. I mean, you open up in Salon. We'll try to make the article available on our own website, saying, you know, the option is, and this is a cliche people use, what's the option? The option is much better to stay alive. Stay alive at all costs. This is sort of the attitude. Keep your consciousness rather than nothingness. But sometimes, one feels that option is not necessarily the best option.
Yeah, you know, the standard line is, well, it's better than the alternative, isn't it? And, you know, I've had years to think about that book that for that research. That book was published about 5 years ago. And I've thought about it, keep thinking about it as I keep getting older and older myself. And it seems to me that it's not always better than the alternative. In fact, often dying, the thought of dying, for me at least, feels like a relief. I would be relieved from the aches and pains of aging. I'd be relieved from my concerns about my state of my mind, which is diminishing. and people who know me and will hear me today will say, oh, that's nonsense. Listen to you. But, you know, when people... There's a sort of folk wisdom that people don't change when they get old. They get more of the same. And I think there's a certain truth to that, so that we hold on to those things at which we were best. I'm not talking about Alzheimer's now. I'm talking about aging, dementia from aging. We hold on to those. So I can hold on to slinging words, whether on paper or on the air. But it's harder.
But we also hold on to hope. And as you point out in your article, ambivalence is kind of the operative word here, that we, particularly when we go into one area, cross one barrier with a parent or ourselves, we think, well, we've got a scrap of something, we'll hold on to that. Some vestige of possibility.
Well, yes, that's the point. I mean, I do not think that this is an easy decision for anyone, including myself. But there's a balance of what kind of life are you willing to live? And at what point do you say, I've had enough? This is not who I am and who I want to be. And also, but there are many other factors. The impact on a family, that Michael Wolff article, The New Yorker, that we were talking about.
New York Magazine, I think.
I'm sorry?
It was a New York
Magazine.
Yeah,
yes.
Excellent article. Yeah.
Which was called A Life Worth Ending. And he documents his mother, who was... A woman who broke barriers in the 40s, I guess, 30s. She was a journalist before women were in journalism. She led an active, useful life, And now she was a vegetable with her diapers needing to be changed. And he was watching this, and yet nobody would pull the plug.
And doctors, your own doctor said to you, no, can't do it, won't do it. As a doctor, I'm healing. I'm not taking life.
Yeah, when I asked my doctor to help me, and it wasn't that.
Help you when you were ready to do it.
When I was ready. I wasn't ready to do it then. I'm still not ready to do it. But I wanted the control. One of the interesting things about the issue of control is Ken and I were talking earlier. No, it wasn't Ken. It was someone else. sorry, Ken. But we were talking, and I was saying that 930, 15 years of right to life, right to die law in Oregon, the oldest one in the country, physicians have written 935 prescriptions. You know how many of them were used?
Well, I know from your article, but give me numbers. Yeah,
only half of them were used. The rest, people were, they just wanted to know that they would not suffer that they could go with dignity.
Well, the traditional exits, like dying in your sleep or even of terminal illness, have become maybe more exotic. And
yeah, Michael, it's really one of the craziest things that's happened in this last century. I'll make two points about it. First of all, we've done better and better and better at keeping people alive longer, which is quite spectacular. Life expectancy jumped from 47 to 78 in one century alone, the 20th century. But we've also gotten better and better and better at keeping people dying longer. And keep in mind also that up until the 20th century, death was a common part of life. People lived on farms. They lived in communities, and the cow died, or the horse was born, and the horse died, and grandma died because she lived in the same house. Now, death is very much a taboo subject. And frankly, I even thought twice and three times before deciding to come on this show today, because I thought, I don't know if I want to be associated with this subject. It's so taboo. But the truth of it is that more and more people are now saying to me, and I'm not a thanatologist, you know, an expert on death and dying. As I give speeches around the country, people are saying, you know what? I've watched what's happened to my mom. I look at my dad who's in diapers, is in a nursing home, or people who aren't who they used to be, or people struggling through horrible and horrific pain after stroke, and they're not even there anymore. I wouldn't want to be that way. I'd rather check out.
The boomers particularly are faced with this.
Boomers are watching their parents, and more people, not in the media, not on the air, but in private discussions at dinner, people all over the country are now seeing and saying, that's not for me. I'd like to have some degree of humanity and dignity and control over my end of life. And I don't want to live necessarily in some horrific pain, extra decade in some hospital with tubes up my nose.
How much of this has to do with the healthcare system? I mean, it makes dying with dignity, to use that phrase, difficult, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've got a healthcare system that doesn't aim towards hospice and palliative care, letting people die comfortably at home. There's a study that recently came out of Singapore where countries are rated all over the world on their ability to facilitate what they call the good death. And that would be a death where people are comfortable, free of pain, have loved ones near, and are treated in a dignified way. Our country did very poorly on this scale. We put people into intensive care. We put wires and tubes all over the place. And by the way, there's a lot of profiteering that goes on by keeping people dying longer. I think when we stop and think about it, we might come to a conclusion that there are probably better ways we can handle the end of life than what we're doing right now.
Well, aside from the expense, I mean, we're talking about really extraordinary number of dollars here. How do you build a system to help the dying achieve what's, you just indicate, maybe most important to them at the end of their lives?
Well, there's a couple of three ways. And one or two of these I might get home and my wife will hit me over the head. Why'd you say that on the air? One of the ways is I think we need to be more comfortable talking about these issues. Doctors and nurses generally are not instructed on how to have this discussion about choices at the end of life. I think we also need to be more realistic. There are some conditions and diseases from which people are not going to return. Third, there's some horrible fear and pain and suffering that people struggle with. Why should we keep that going longer? Why can't we more support people and reimburse people for the dying process at home? And I'd also say that I think for the boomers who have never been a stoic bunch, more psychodrama queens and kings, I don't think the boomers are going to want to suffer for 5 or 10 years. And I actually think that suicide is going to become increasingly commonplace in this culture. And that's, I know, a really sensitive sensitive zone.
Talk about taboos, huh?
I wouldn't bet on that.
Well, Lillian Rubin, you mentioned a statistic before, close to 25% of the medical budget in the last year of life, and much of that is in the last few months, which really doesn't help a whole lot. The cost of dementia care, though, and you've gone through this personally with your late husband, Hank, taking care of him when he had Alzheimer's, this year is $200 billion. By 2050, it's apt to be around $1 trillion.
That's public costs, right?
Yeah.
What about the private costs, the cost that bankrupts families because they still have money and don't qualify for public care?
Well, what can we do? I mean, aside from perhaps what's been done in Oregon, you've got people who are demented. The family wants, many instances, just want to keep them alive, to have them there as a soul or a living presence.
Well, first of all, Ken's more the what can we do guy than I am. I feel
you've lived through it, though. That's why I want to hear what you.
I'm sorry.
I say you've lived through it.
And what could we have done? We could have had home nursing care, home care for my husband, so that I wouldn't have been the only caretaker. So I could have gotten out of the house and lived some kind of life before I put him into external care because I could physically no longer take care of him. But we could have nursing care is far less expensive than institutional care. So the whole idea of keeping people at home and letting them die peacefully that Ken was talking about is crucial. But more important, before we can get there, we need to change. We need to work towards changing the whole culture. Ken is arguing or has said that he thought the baby boomers wouldn't tolerate this. I have watched them for many years, and I think they'll have the same ambivalence. I know, I'll bet, there'll be some small number of them who will say, I want to go. But what you call these kings and queens and princes aren't going to want to go. They're going to want the government and somebody do something for them at all costs. And they will talk in conversation. They'll say, I never want to live with the way my mother lived and my father. I will do something. But there's always that unless, and I write about that in the article, a guy who gave clear instructions. He didn't want to be on tubes. He didn't want to have any excessive care. He wanted to be allowed to die. But there's always an unless. Unless somebody thinks there's a way that he could return to normal. In other words, unless there's a miracle. My mother, who used to, every time I went to see her, would say, oh, why doesn't God take me? And finally, one day, I said to her, Mom, if you really mean that, I'll help you. And she looked at me, classical Jewish mother line, what? You want to kill me? God will take care of it when he's ready. Well, God didn't take care of it. I had to take care of it because she now slipped into the diaper stage. She was in pain. She was totally not lucid. And she developed pneumonia. And a doctor calls me up and says, tells me, and he says, we're instituting treatment, which is antibiotics. And I said, no. And I had to have this discussion in which he shamed me for not letting him do his best to keep. How do you know she couldn't come back, he said to me. Well, I didn't, but he didn't either. But I knew if she came back, she'd still live that life.
This kind of gets to the heart of the problem in many ways, Ken Dykewall. I mean, the burden on the healthcare system, the burden on families, the really inaccessibility of knowing fully what's going to happen down the line, the mystery of death and all that. I mean, used to be pneumonia was called the old person's friend, but not anymore because, as you say, they got all the gadgets and ways to hook people up and just keep them alive. But there's a cultural question that goes deeper here. I want to get your response to what Lillian said about the boomers, but there's a really profound cultural system that we're grappling with, and that is the sense of how forbidden the topic this all is.
Yeah, it's boy. I bet some people are listening to this saying, "I can't believe we're talking about this on the air." I think this topic, the winds of change will be that this topic is going to become more and more commonplace in discussion in the years to come. There's just too many people thinking about it, talking about it, writing about it. And I think we also need to, let's take a moment here to kind of spread it out a little bit. On the one hand, we're talking about a family deciding, we've had enough of dad, maybe we ought to off him. That's not what I'm talking about. And by the way, there is worry about that. I mean, there ought to be worry about that. That kind of abuse could
occur. Especially if dad's got a big will.
Yeah, dad's got some money and we're kind of tired of this and it's very expensive and we're having to give up our life. I don't think that we're ever going to cross that line where that what's called active euthanasia. But then gentle down that continuum a little bit, and you've got a situation where someone wishes not to be kept alive through extraordinary means, where someone wishes to die a natural death. And we haven't even made that easy or acceptable. You need all sorts of directives and documents and contracts, which not everybody has. And then you take it one step further down the line, and it's not society saying, Michael, it's your time. It's time for you to step off the air or step off this planet.
Like Governor Lamb used to say, a leaf falls and another one will come in his place.
Well, I knew Governor Lamb. He had this line, older people had a duty to die, and that was pretty well the end of his career once he uttered that publicly.
It's actually true.
But further down the line is the idea that maybe an individual, because of their situation or their wishing not to be a burden on their family or their belief that what's coming is just going to be years of horror and nightmare, would like to let the end come sooner. And maybe they even need help with that, assisted suicide or suicide. And I think that each of those are different. Each of those are a different discussion, but somehow they all get lumped together and then not talked about at all. And so here we are starting to spread it out across the table and say, what are the things we're actually reflecting on here?
And what about the way they do it, for example, in Holland? I mean, they actually have, people come in, family, physicians, but also spiritual church, synagogue member, whatever, and they make a collective decision.
Yeah, they make a collective decision. There are countries like Holland and Belgium and Switzerland for whom for many years now this has been quite acceptable and people haven't been storming down the doors. A small percentage of the public takes advantage of it. There's even one firm in Switzerland that will allow you to come from other parts of the world and enjoy a wonderful dinner and an evening and come to terms with your life and your end will come about. It sounds a little bit like the Soylent Green movie, I know.
I don't know about Swiss cuisine either.
Maybe not for you. But I do think that these kinds of choices – see, the idea is if somebody decides to do it to you, that sort of goes back to Nazi Germany, and I don't think anybody's keen on that theme. But the idea that you might have some personal choice, that you might be able to not find yourself outside of your control in a circumstance where other people are forcing you to remain alive in some extraordinary way, I think a lot of people are thinking, I don't think I want to be in that situation. What else might we talk about here? So personal choice, I think, is going to be this is going to play forward.
That's all that Lillian was arguing for, really.
That's all the thing I argue for. I don't,
Lillian's not saying she decides at the end of the show she'd like for me to end my life.
Yeah.
She's saying that when her time comes, and by the way, I'll ask you a question, Lillian. Some people would say it's great courage. There are cultures where the elders went off out of courage and respect and meditated their way to the end of their lives.
Right.
And other people would say it's great cowardice.
That's exactly right.
Where do you come out?
I think the line between courage and cowardice on deciding about one's death is very fluid. So in my more courageous moments, I call it courageous, I plan it. And
you literally sit down and you plan it.
I have a plan. I have the drugs that are supposed to do the job.
Derek Humphreys, courtesy of? Remember he wrote all those books.
Yeah, well, Compassionate Choices, the people who came after him. I have the protocol. I have someone who has agreed to help me.
This is a novel by Ian McEwan called Amsterdam, actually, that you just described. I mean, sets it up ahead of time and so forth.
It's all set up.
If somebody helps you, isn't that murder?
Yeah,
under the law,
if they knew about it.
Under the law, that person could be held for murder.
Yes, and people are very hesitant to make the commitment, partly because of the legal issues, but equally important, and maybe more so, because I think I could cover we could cover that up, so there wasn't a legal issue, but the or didn't come to anybody's attention. But the big issue is, these people are all people who really care about me, and they are going to be saddened by my death, and I'm asking them to help me.
But
only
people who have helped, husbands have been prosecuted who, you know, cherish their wives, but felt the pain was too much and wanted to get.
Yes, it's possible.
It can't be prosecuted. Kids,
but there's also there are also ways to avoid that.
But what about, you know, death panels? Again, the cultural response to that was electric when Sarah Palin supposedly mentioned death panels or when it came up with respect to the recent health care bill. Again, it's something that Americans, and that's part of that freedom that you're talking about, Lillian. That is, I want the autonomy to decide. I don't want a panel in the Netherlands or a death panel of any kind.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if we don't have some kind of limits on the public expenditures in such situations, you know, Medicare will fail. That's true. It's not true about Social Security, but it's true about Medicare. And as these baby boomers, 78 million of them, come onto Medicare, the burden will be enormous. And the increased longevity, there's no way around this problem unless you have some kind of, in Canada, for example.
Let me just say, by the way, there's a new study that just came out today by the Lucile Packard Foundation for Children's Health, which says that, and this is a nationwide phenomenon, but particularly in California, the number of children being born has gone down. And, of course, the elder population continues to go up.
That's right. And the baby boomers themselves had fewer children.
But what this is doing to the coffers of this state and every other state, is almost beyond.
It's almost beyond imagination.
Well, Ken, get back to the boomers, though. You don't agree with Lillian on that.
I almost agree with Lillian on it. And I'm glad to have the chance even to talk about it because normally we think about these things. So let me tell you how I see it. I generally disagree with Sarah Palin on pretty well everything there is to disagree about. But I agree with her. I wouldn't want there to be some group of people deciding who should live and who should die. To me, that's wrong, period. On the other hand, I think individuals should not feel that there's something horribly wrong with them should they believe that they've reached a stage in life or they're in a particular position with a terminal disease where they would like to have some choice. Lillian makes a very important point. Of all the states that have legalized assisted suicide, a certain number of people, very small percent, less than 1% have actually taken advantage of this. And only about half the people actually use the pills. But they feel better knowing it's their choice. Yeah. And in the middle of that is creating a healthcare system that is far more respectful of dignified end of life. That's more focused on hospice and palliative care so that however it unfolds, it's done in a way that people feel whole as a human being and families are allowed to nurture and support without feeling like something crazy is going on.
All right. Well, we've opened up this Pandora's box. Let me invite those of you listening to join us. You may have stories. You certainly may have questions and comments, and we welcome your participating in this conversation. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. Again, it's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We're talking with Lillian Rubin and Ken Dykewald, and we'll return and hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're having a discussion this hour about something that often is not discussed, and that is the end of life and what one should do or what one should consider as life edges toward the end. And then Ken Dykewald is with us. He's a psychologist, gerontologist, and president and CEO of AgeWave. It's an organization that focuses on studying population aging and its business, social, healthcare, and cultural implications. And Lillian B. Rubin, who is a sociologist and psychologist, who published an article recently called Let's Talk About Dying in Salon, in fact, on December 27th. She's also the author of 60 On Up, The Truth About Aging in America. And we welcome your thoughts about this difficult subject, a subject that really touches all our lives, whether we like to think it or not. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Other ways to communicate with us, you can go to our Facebook page or you can tweet us, our Twitter handle at KQED Forum. And let me bring you in with calls here. Shauna, good morning.
Good morning. This topic has really been on my mind lately. My husband passed away in August of ALS. It was a 7-year illness, and at the beginning of his illness, I told him that I would be supportive of him through this illness, be there for him with as much love and compassion as possible. But with ALS, there is the option of going on a respirator and keeping the person alive even longer. And I really knew that that wasn't something that I emotionally or physically could handle. The caretaking with ALS is just incredible. I mean, and it caused a lot of, you know, grief within our family. I mean, he initially you know, said to me, "Why don't you want me to be alive?" And, you know, and I did, you know, but I wanted him to be alive in a good way. At the end, he decided, you know, that he wanted to, within 10 days before his death, he said, "I want to be gone in 10 days. And he visited with all his friends, and he was gone. And he agreed with me at the end that, that I was right. But, you know, I feel like today, we have the medical means to keep people alive, but we don't have the support system in place to support the caretakers. I feel like I'm suffering trauma right now just from this 7-year ordeal of caretaking. You know, the financial consequences, the physical, you know, my teenage son turned to drugs. I mean, there's all different things that happen, and, you know, we just haven't caught up as a society to take care of the whole process, you know. And I just think the basic thing that people, that what I would say is for, you need to keep that line of communication open, and you need to be honest with your loved one so that they know what you can handle and they can make their decisions accordingly.
Well, Shauna, thank you. And Kenny Dykewell, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, so Shauna, thanks for your call and respects to you and what you've been through. There's tens and tens of millions of Americans going through now one or another version of what you just described. And partly the issue is if there's an individual who is in decline, there's likely two or three caregivers. It could be costing $50,000 to $100,000 a year for 5 or 10 years, which might bankrupt the family. It's causing attention to go away from people's careers and their children and all sorts of other things. But then there's still the fundamental question is who decides? And in this situation, we would imagine that the individual, your husband, is the key decision maker here about his life, because it would be a slippery slope, I think, if all of a sudden people said this is an inconvenience, so we're going to take action whether the patient or the victim wants it or not. I'm involved with an organization called Us Against Alzheimer's, and you know, we have 5 million people with Alzheimer's right now, which has got 100% fatal, 100% untreatable, 100% incurable. And a lot of people say to me, if I get diagnosed with that disease, what that will do to my – I won't really know what's happening at some point. I don't want that – I don't want what would happen to my family to happen. So I would like my life to end. I've heard that so many times, Michael, I can't even tell you.
Well, you asked me off air what my take is on this, and I said I'd like the pills close by because things like Alzheimer's or ALS just seem, you know, to be almost irreconcilable, although for some people they do quite well and they have extraordinary ability to adapt to circumstances like that. I mean, there's some heroic stories, and there are also heroic stories, I have to mention here, in the caretaking side of things. You know, Lillian's been through this. I remember interviewing First Lady Rosalynn Carter, you know, who wrote a whole book on caretaking, and the idea of just the heroic nature of some of the, but what they sacrifice. I mean, you were talking about it before. You didn't have a life when your late husband was.
Well, you know, I'm not, you know, you use the word heroic, and I'm not at all convinced it's heroic. I mean, Shauna just said it. She was losing her life, and she had no choice. We do these things because we have a sense of humanity and obligation. But
can I tell you what else I think it is? Because I'm writing a book on this now, so I might as well get it out there. I think a lot of it has to do with honoring those we love.
With what?
Honoring those we love.
What do you mean?
I mean, you honor somebody, they may be just a shell of what they were before, and yet you take care of them and you give up your life sometimes because of a sense of honoring what they were. And
Michael, that may be true, but in the time you're doing it, this isn't who they were, especially with Alzheimer's.
No, it's not.
This isn't who they are. You have a body that looks familiar, but there's no person to go with the body. And I want to tell you, I was in a 50-year, you know, great marriage. And by the time Hank died, it was, I mourned, but it was a relief. I'm still mourning, but it took till the first anniversary of his death when my daughter and I went to, his ashes were scattered in the Berkeley Botanical Gardens because he loved flowers. And so we went to the site, and it was then that I could finally recapture the man he was and the man I loved. I had his old pictures all over my office, on my iPhone, to remind me through that year who Hank was. But my inner response was still to the last five years of dementia.
Oh, you were living with, like I said, a shell of what he had.
That's
been,
right. Yeah. So, yes, I honored my...
You honored who he was to
I
you.
I honored who he was, but I also... Look, when I put Hank into care, there were good friends of mine who said to me, well, you didn't have to. You know, you could have hired somebody to take care of him.
And you felt guilty when
I felt
when
very
he died
guilty.
Because maybe if he'd been in your care, he wouldn't have died.
Absolutely.
You wrote about that in another piece in Salon.
About
becoming a widow. Ken, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I think there's something, just to put it out on the table, we live in a culture, you know, sometimes we swing a little too far this way, a little too far that way. We live in a culture that is where there's such a denial of death. We want to look young, act young, be young. The idea of somebody getting sick, oh, they can get better. There's a cure. There's a treatment. And there are circumstances for every one of us where we're not going to get younger. We're not going to play volleyball again. We are in a death spiral. But it's so uncomfortable to consider that, to embrace it. And our physicians are generally not comfortable, and our nurses talking to us about it. And not everybody can afford a good therapist to help them.
Can you embrace that? Is that something you can use that word, and I wonder why. Can you embrace what you
I would have to tell you
that
spiral? I'll get personal. I'll step out of my professional role. So I have a mom and dad who just had their 70th wedding anniversary, and they're hurting. They're wonderful, but they're hurting. My dad is blind from diabetes. He's losing some of his cognitive functions. My mother spends 3 hours a day on a respirator. She's got cognitive impairment as well. She broke her pelvis last year. I don't want them ever to die. I call them every single night. I try to see them every several months. My brother, who lives in New Jersey, who I know is listening to the show, is equally, if not more, involved with their lives. I'd like for them to be involved forever. But guess what? They're not going to be alive and involved in my life forever.
So you embrace that?
I'm trying to. It's hard.
Yeah, damn hard. Let me get another caller on here. And we go to Alberta, Canada. Matthew, join us.
Hi, Michael. First, before I begin my comment, I really want to say that I like and support your point of view of honoring somebody and allowing them or escorting them out of this life. I'll go to my comment. I'm happy to take it offline, of course. My name is Matthew Hill. I'm a 42-year-old American living in Canada. I have almost died twice. The second time, most seriously, was from a severe head injury, and my father, who was a radiologist, a neuroradiologist, was one of the physicians who worked day and night to keep me alive. I'm lucky. I am so lucky in that I didn't die, and I recovered the use of the left side of my body, which was paralyzed, and my cognitive functions, which were severely damaged. In subsequent years, though, that brought an awareness of death to me very early on. I like to say that my adolescence lasted about a year and a half, if that. And in conversations with my father, and this is really the point I want to make, as a Western physician, he is bound to the Hippocratic Oath that he took when he became a physician. He is mandated by his doctrine and by the law to preserve life at all costs whenever possible. Physicians do not make, cannot make, are not socially and legally are not allowed to make any decision that involves death. So until we can wrap our brains around a Western society, as one of your speakers was talking about how we want to avoid death. I'm a long-distance runner. I want to stay able to run, but I recognize that I am getting gray hair, and I'm at 42, I'm past the middle of my life, more than likely. At what point, and this is where I come to from having my head injury, and I know what it's like to be cared for, somebody to help me to drop my shorts when I have to go to the bathroom and wipe myself and get myself back together. I've been in that situation. When you're at that point, you are no longer alive. You're no longer actively participating in your life. And as you were writing about in your book, honoring somebody and allowing them to take that step out of life to death, which is as part as much a part of life as I just said to my coworkers, paying taxes is. But it's a societal change. It's a legal change. It's an awareness change that has to come about where we are all not willing to accept death, but that recognize that death is everybody's end destination. And then when families and loved ones are then legally allowed to interact with their physicians and say, okay, when can we decide to honor somebody and let them out? Now, of course, there's going to be abuses of this, wrong applications of it.
You know, there's not but only that, Matthew. I have to jump in with something else here. There's also the problem. I mean, Lillian spoke about having a friend help and everything. But if it's discovered, or if it's even somebody doesn't help you, if you do it yourself and it's discovered that it was a suicide, your insurance becomes a problem.
Well, no, they love it because they don't have to pay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, it's not a problem for them.
It's not a problem for them. I mean, it's a problem for your family and those who succeed you. I mean, that's
right. And also, there's the, you know, if a child or a teenager commits suicide, then people is hush hush because it's a perception that somehow something terrible had happened in that family.
Well, it's a perception in that family that the family has failed.
Right. And so, even mentioning that an individual had taken their own life, people don't even know how to react to that right now. Do we say, I respect that they had taken their end of life into their own hands? Or do we say something is sick and weird and wrong with that family and that person that they did such a horrible thing? I think that discussion is going to be a raging discussion in the years to come.
And let me thank Matthew for the call. Lillian Rubin, yeah. Here's Valerie, who writes, I'm 43 years old and was diagnosed with terminal cancer last year. I am facing some of the same issues you're talking about on today's show. It is hard enough to talk about the end-of-life plans with friends and family. I think doctors and others in the healthcare industry absolutely need to be on board with the patient's end-of-life decisions. I don't think my decision to spend my last days in the comfort of my home will be well received by my medical team. When should this topic be broached with a person's healthcare team? Talk about tough questions. Well,
what was the question, Michael?
When do you talk about this with your healthcare team? Well, you talk to your doctor, but she's saying she has terminal cancer. She wants to ask them.
I think she should talk to her doctor, her healthcare team now. Let them know what she wants. She should have a written protocol. It's very easy to get, and I think you get them online, of a healthcare proxy that says what she wants. And insists that she doesn't, whatever the line is that she wants to draw.
Did you write about somebody in your piece in Salon who, in fact, it got you very angry, who was going to be on life support, and one of the members of the family, there was a decision.
The father was ready to pull the plug.
Ready to pull the plug, as they say.
And the daughter
screamed and said, how can you do this? I'll never talk to you again. Right.
And I was angry at hearing that from him. And my question was, who is she fighting for? Herself? Some unfinished business with her mother? Or is she really caring for her mother? And what about her father, who was, she was going to consign him to maybe years of living like this, while she was going to go home wherever she lived, with our children and family, and it was going to be his problem. She'd call up once in a while. Yes, I think this is simply not acceptable. But the issue is really whether we have – it comes right down to the basic. Do we have a right to say my life – do I have a right? Does any individual in America have a right to say, I'm finished, my life is over? I'm not talking about teenage kids and the kind of angst
you also bring up – when you bring up this question, you bring up all the religious questions that are associated with it.
That's what comes into people's minds. I know that. But that has no part in public policy. That's a private issue. The religious questions are a private issue. Public policy is something
Church
else.
Church and state. Yeah. Ken Dykel.
So, Lillian, how old are you now?
In 3 days or four, I'll be 89.
A happy birthday. So Lillian is saying that she'd like to feel that it's her own.
And there are three stages of life, you know that. Youth, middle age, and you look great.
Lillian is basically saying that she feels that part of a democracy should allow her to say that I'd like to make this decision on my own account. So let's put that on. Let's put that right there for a second. But I want to challenge the call, the Matthew's call for a second, and challenge it with respect, Matthew, that I don't know that when the Hippocratic Oath was conceived about preserving life at any cost, there were all the gizmos and tools and gadgets and
Actually,
techniques.
It mainly says do no harm is what it says.
Right. It doesn't say preserve life at any cost. So that's an interesting interpretation of it. But there are ways that people can be kept alive now for days, years, decades. And by the way, we all know in the healthcare field, those work in the field, there's a great deal of profiteering in that game, that by keeping somebody alive in intensive care an extra couple, 5, 10 days, that's a lot of money being exchanged for extending that death process. I'm not sure that that's what doctors' jobs should be. I think that if more attention was given to listening to what people's concerns are, to providing psychological care, because they might be depressed, and that's not something that should be immediately jumped on or responded to, and hoping to bring them to a healthy, well-adjusted life. But if people have choices, they should be honored and respected, and we should have more means to let people be cared for at home in a humane, loving, supportive way, rather than this other thing that happens most of the time.
Let me read another email and then go to some more calls. Patsy writes, thank you for this program. As an ICU nurse, I have been seen way too many people kept going long after it was kind or made sense to die with a crushed chest from CPR because no one wanted to speak up about death and dying as a tragedy. We in this country need to have a great deal more education and discussion about this subject to counteract the wacko death panel folks and others who are just uncomfortable talking about this very personal subject.
Thank you.
Let me go to a caller, John. John, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for this opportunity to talk about this important topic with you. I wanted to go back to the death panel issue, because there's nothing in the Affordable Care Act that was going to have somebody not involved in your care making a decision about whether you individually live or die. It had two components. One is, because we are a fee-for-service system, it would reimburse physicians for having these conversations with their own patients. And the second is, there would be best practices panels, and their job is to identify the best practices around palliative care and end-of-life care in general. But nobody was going to be making a decision about you that wasn't already actively involved in your care.
Point well taken.
Yeah.
Ken,
yeah.
Lillian?
Yeah. Yes, and the fact that it became an issue, you know, partly out of this powerful, crazy right wing that we have now that's so active and vocal and organized. But the message resonated in the larger culture. The 70% of people, or 60, whatever it is, who don't like the Affordable Care Act aren't those crazy people. They're people who were just – the message resonated to their visceral experience. And we have to keep having these kind of public conversation nationally – out loud, in the hope that we can give people who feel as I do, for example, a voice to stand against some of this other stuff, the religious stuff and other stuff that doesn't tolerate. I can't tolerate the idea of death.
Oh, it's a big stigma for many religions, as I'm looking at some of the emails here.
But real quick, let me just add one other piece. I don't feel like that the Affordable Care Act went far enough. I thought there was far too little attention on long-term care. I think there's not enough respect given to palliative care and hospice care workers. I think there's way too little reimbursement focused on geriatric medicine, where real meaningful discussions and choices can be reflected on. So I just feel like we're not there yet. We haven't gone far enough down the street.
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Ken. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I think the power, the numbers, and education of the baby boomers will force changes, I will hope, in hospice care and end-of-life care. But my question is, you know the TV show House, a dramatic TV show with that irascible character, Dr. Gregory House, in a episode or a series of episodes where a friend of his was dying terminally and had no chance of recovery, he commented that when someone looked askance at a suggestion about euthanasia, he said, "We'll do what we always do, increase their morphine at night, and they won't wake up." Now, my question is, does that happen, and has that been something
all the time? All the time. Let's be real. There are compassionate and respectful doctors and families all over the world, right here in the United States. I've had hundreds and hundreds tell me the story that they know it's not legal, but they think the right thing to do is to make it comfortable and easy for the person to have that transition with the least amount of pain and suffering.
It's again, one of the untold
stories.
Many
hospice workers do it too.
Yeah.
Or at worst, they will leave instructions with the caretaker and leave and let the caretaker do it.
There's a lot of things we don't talk about, as we've said here, that are verboten topics, but this especially because there are a lot of people who could be in big trouble because it's, I don't mean to make it sound like it's ubiquitous, but it is very widespread from what we know. Here's Joe who says, "I think this issue, end of life and death, is an incredibly important one. I've had the unfortunate privilege of removing my child from life support. His condition would have necessitated a tube to eat and all manner of life-limiting conditions. Modern medicine is amazing. It would have given my wife and I the ability to extend our child's life, and yet the quality of that life for us was a compromise neither of us could bear to ask for a baby with no advocate except two grieving parents dealing with letting go of a dream. The doctors wouldn't do it, remove the feeding tube, and I can understand why. It's a painful memory for me, feeling like I killed my child some 9 years later, and I can't imagine a doctor wanting to shoulder that burden." I mean, there it is again, you know, that sense of just this impossible kind
of that's the point. When
conundrum.
People get into this position, they're in an impossible bind. They can't get medical help. And they can't, they don't want to be murderers.
But let's also, here's the truth of it all, that this isn't something that, these questions are not questions that happens to that other family down the road. Every single family is talking about these issues. By the way, Michael, just between you and me, we're friends outside of the show. I give you a lot of credit for wanting to open this topic up on the air. Most people won't. You know, it's like, okay, how to take hormones and live to be 100. You know,
that's
what everybody wants to talk about, how to age young. The idea of just having a discussion about these issues, letting people feel like they're not weird if they're questioning these things. And also,
as I get older, I take more chances and get more edgy, maybe.
There you go. I think that... by the way, I do believe, as someone who's tracked the boomers now, I'm a boomer myself. I was born in 1950. I think this is the generation that talked about pimples. They talked about sex. They talked about marital discord. They've changed their religions. They've changed their families. They've put things out in the open that other generations were more stoical and reserved about. I think this generation is going to take death out of the closet. I think we've learned a lot from the suffering and the celebrations that went on around people dying who experienced AIDS. There was, you know, here in San Francisco, there were celebratory funerals because people had so much practice at how do we deal with transition. Let's treat it with respect and care and love of that person's life. I think the boomers are going to make these topics more popular, less stoic, less reserved, less uptight. And I do believe that there's going to be more of a movement towards people taking these things under their own control.
I believe that, too. I don't have as much faith in the boomers as you do.
Well, here's Sue who writes.
Then you should stay around a long time so that you can get to see how we do.
We'd like to see that, really. Here's Sue who writes, "My mom suffered for 11 years with Alzheimer's disease. Her dying was an event unlike what I would have expected. Even after she was taken off the feeding tube, it took nearly a month for her to actually die. Towards the end of her life, I brought a small radio to her bedside and left on music she always loved. She had not been verbal in more than 5 years, but she smiled with the music. It made me think we don't really know a lot about the dying process." I think that's a fair enough point. I mean,
it's a fair point,
too. It's a very, very, very fair point and very true. We have no idea. You know, doctors tell patients whose loved one is in a coma, talk to them. But they admit they don't know whether the patient could hear.
My mother was in a coma and showed no response, and we told her that it was her 70th wedding anniversary on that day, and I saw a smile, you know.
Really?
And at that point, you know, it was a question of feeding tube. And if you see a smile and somebody can be in a coma and they may be not responsive, does that mean that you do the feeding tube or you well, don't this do the feeding
is,
tube.
But a critical point here is rather than you or a sibling making the decision, if your mom or my mom had a set of wishes about what quality of life would be required for her to want those feeding tubes to keep her going. I think this quality of life issue, and then the point really is, well, who decides?
Well, because it's so forbidden a topic, you have people who feel they have to suddenly decide, and what am I going to do? Am I going to kill my parent here? I mean, that's what comes out.
That's exactly right.
But, and what's mom's wishes?
But I think it's more than having that health care statement of what you want and how you want to die. Because, for one thing, doctors will fight against it often. Families sometimes change their mind, as I've written about. But I think there's something else. And this comes back to we all keep saying the individual, and I'm all for that. But there's also a matter of social policy here. At what point does the state have a right? It's paying for this health care. Children are going hungry to pay these, and we can't afford, we say, to feed them because we have these bills to pay. At what point do we triage, if you will? They triage on a battlefield. In places like Canada, I have a friend who needed knee surgery, 45-year-old guy who was having trouble walking. They made a decision. He would wait the 6 or 8 months online because other people were in greater immediate need.
I have to make a decision here, and it's to end the program, as much as I hate to do that, because we've come to the end of it. It's been a tough topic. Thank you both for your passion and for your articulateness. Ken Dykewald, Lillian Rubin, appreciate you both being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Great to see
Thanks
you.
For the Thanks, chance
man.
To talk about this.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.